This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. What are you looking at right now? Are you seeing the road ahead as you're driving your car? Or are you looking at your computer in the office? Take a moment to focus on the things around you. As believers, we need to have a clear focus on the cross of Christ so we can live out our faith. Today, Pastor Ben will begin a sermon from Numbers 21, titled, Look and Live. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
If you have your Bibles, please turn with me to Numbers chapter 21, and then eventually we'll get into John chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. I want to tell you a story or a circumstance from my childhood as I was growing up. When I was in middle school, I had to go for an eyesight check. How many of you ever been to an eye exam? Raise your hand. All right, many of you have. Some of you didn't raise your hand. Strange, seeing that you have glasses on, but that's okay. I'm not going to judge this morning. In fact, I went to the eye doctor and I saw that I was having a difficulty seeing, and he said, "Hey, let's get your eyes checked." And so they eventually did the exam, and he discovered that my eyesight was 2700. That means what someone sees at 20 feet with perfect vision, it appears that it's 700 feet away for me. How did I even get through like middle school and elementary? I don't know. But I had terrible vision. And the way the doctor determined that is he put this optical thing next to my face, and I looked and peered through these two holes, and he would change lenses in this device. Maybe you've been there, and he'll say something like this, which option looks clearer, option one or option two? They always have this like super methodical way of saying it. Option three or option four? And you're supposed to say, well, option one looks better, option four looks better, A or B. But before long, as he was doing this, he was adjusting the lenses, it actually started to improve my vision. And so what I was looking at on the wall became clear. The fuzziness started to go away, the ability for me to have crisp lines on the letters was there. And so he gave me my glasses, and that day I walked out with a pair of glasses and a pair of rec specs, and as I played baseball and I could see the chalkboard at school, and actually it was transformational. At times, our eyesight as Christians can become woefully out of focus. In fact, in 2 Peter verse chapter 1, we learn that if godly characteristics aren't abounding in our lives, Peter actually describes us as being nearsighted. He says the idea is the meaning that we've forgotten that we've been cleansed from our former sins. And so the focus of our spiritual eyesight matters. Actually, what we are beholding as Christians really matters. And this morning, we will see that the cross of Christ must be the lens that we see all of life through. And the brief idea I want you to go away with, what I've been thinking about this week, is by faith, look to the cross and live. By faith, look to the cross and live. And this morning, we'll understand the background of the story. We will look at four observations from the text, look at three Christ connections, and then we'll have two broad applications for our lives today. So let me give you that quick overview of how we got to this text. Well, the first, the book of Numbers is really about two generations. The first generation is the one that was delivered out of Egypt. They saw the incredible work of God by sending the 10 plagues and how God divided the Red Sea, and they led them to safety. God then brought the people to Mount Sinai, where the people received the 10 commandments. And this is where God entered into a covenant with them. And he said, "You're my chosen people. I will be your God, and you will be my people." The covenant was quickly broken when Aaron decided to construct a golden calf. But the Lord, in his grace and mercy, provided a way for him to dwell with his people. And he gave the instructions of the tabernacle. And so in the book of Numbers, the first 10 chapters actually take place at Mount Sinai. And there's a couple things that happen. First of all, there's a census that's taken as the people prepare for battle. As they're about to journey in the promised land, there was the reality. They needed to know who could fight and who couldn't. And then they organized the camp. They organized the camp in a certain way, which essentially made an X or a cross. And at the center was the tabernacle and then the Levites. And then you had all the other tribes that would come off of the center of the tabernacle. And then there was the role of the Levites that were explained in chapters 3 to 5. And then there were laws about ritual purity from 5 to 10. And then in chapter 10, the cloud of the Lord's presence lifts from the tabernacle. And the people of Israel follow the cloud to travel to the wilderness of Paran. And the Israelites are instructed to follow a cloud. So it's very simple. Where the cloud goes, you go. But the things begin to go wrong very quickly. The Israelites begin to complain. They complain about the hardships of the journey, verse 1 of chapter 11. They complain about the lack of variety of food in verse 4 of chapter 11. Moses, in chapter 12, Moses' own relatives, Miriam and Aaron, begin to criticize his wife, who was a foreigner. And then the journey has gone off to a terrible start. And in chapter 13, Moses chooses 12 men to go into the promised land to explore the land. And he gives them instructions to see what the military ability of the occupying nation is, and also to observe the agricultural fruitfulness and potential of the land. And so they go in, they explore. And those 12 men come back. And 10 of them out of the 12 are absolutely sure that they will be defeated if they go into the land. It's a bad idea. We shouldn't go. And guess what happens? The people are brought up into an uproar. There's more complaining that ensues. And they begin to say things like, "Hey, if only we had died in Egypt or even in the wilderness, that would be better than going into this land to be killed. Why is the Lord taking us to this country only for us to die in battle? Our families will be carried off. It would be better for us to go back to Egypt. Let's find a new leader." They found their hope as being to go back to Egypt. What actually could bring them true security in their eyes was Egypt and not the Lord. So God, of course, is understandably angry. Yet Moses intercedes for his people on the basis of the covenant that God made with his people. God, these are your people. Please do not destroy them. And so God grants to the people what they really wanted, not to go into the promised land. And for 40 years, they wander in the wilderness. And this first generation is not permitted to go in the land, and they die. So finally, in Numbers 20, the second generation comes to leadership, and they are ready to travel out of the wilderness of Paran. and they're ready to go to the promised land. And so in their travels, things become bumpy again. They quickly get to a spot and they're thirsty. They have no water and they complain. This is Numbers chapter 20, verses 2 to 5. And so Moses goes to the rock. He's told what to do, to speak to the rock, but instead he actually takes his staff and he strikes the rock out of anger. And Moses doesn't honor the Lord. Instead, Moses is actually not able to go into the wilderness. He's not able to go into the promised land, just like the generation that didn't trust and obey the Lord. And so they're on their travels again, and they come to a place called Edom. And if they cross Edom, they'll walk right in the promised land. But they go to the king of Edom and say, Edom, can we cross your land? And he says, no, I don't want you, all this huge group of people, to cross my land. And so what do the Israelites do? They travel around Edom to go to the promised land. And we come to Numbers chapter 21, and this is part of the journey where they are. They're probably a third of the way through that journey, going around Edom, and here they are, and the people are discouraged. We find very quickly in verse 4 that the people are incredibly discouraged. The text says the people became impatient on the way. Why would they be discouraged? Well, the heat probably during this time of year was excruciating. The journey, the terrain was very rough. I don't know about you, but if there's a pothole on I-85, I complain. But there were more than just potholes as they were traveling. This was terrible, terrible conditions. Not only that, but the direction of the travel seemed to be wrong. They were going away from the promised land. Actually, they were heading towards Egypt, and they were going to do this U around Edom. And so to someone who is just tagging along in the caravan, this seems totally the wrong way to go. God, what are you doing? I want to be done following the cloud. Well, these were real hardships. They were real challenges. Sometimes as Christians, we can come to a challenge in our lives and we can kind of overlook it and be like, well, it's not that big of a deal. And no, these were actually real challenges. And what was induced was these people became discouraged. It's this sorrowful impatience that the difficulties will not abate. And so let me ask you this question. How do we deal with discouragement as believers? I believe Dana Ortlund, in an article that he wrote, wrote these two ways that actually we have the potential to choose or deal with discouragement. One is we could gradually grow cynical by allowing the discouragements of life to beat out any sense of eternal destiny and wonder that God gave us at conversion. We grow in cynicism in the midst of our discouragement. Or we could do this. We can leverage these discouragements of life to enter into a deeper reality with God and the truths that we confess. So we have two opportunities in the moment of discouragement. And guess what the Israelites choose? They chose the path of cynicism. And it's imperative for us to know that when discouragements of life hit the fan, we have this choice to respond. Either we can look to heaven and say, oh God, the hardship, the trial, the difficulty is so heavy on my soul, but you are my God. I will trust in you. You are the shepherd that will never leave me nor forsake me. It is possible to be faith-filled, to have a faith-filled response. Or we can act as if God is not in the situation at all. We can grow anxious because it all depends on us to figure out the answer. We grow cynical because we feel like others don't understand. We can complain because there's nothing to be thankful for. We can be filled with regret because we wish that we could go back and change it all. This response requires no faith. It's your heart, and it's what my heart naturally want to do. So maybe you're here today thinking, well, Ben, I actually really don't get discouraged. I'm actually really great. My life's good. You know, I don't really, you know, struggle with discouragement. And maybe you're in that moment. And I want to respond to you as Charles Spurgeon responded to the same sentiment. He said this, "Dear brother, be thankful that you do not be discouraged, but let me warn you not to judge others. If you are like great bullocks, oxen full of strength, do not get pushing with horn and shoulder those who happen to be the weak cattle. For the Lord takes note of the haughty looks and proud words." He goes on to say this I do know, both by observation and experience, that there are many true pilgrims who will enter the king's country triumphantly at the last, who nevertheless are occasionally much discouraged because of the way. So the discouragement of our life, even you may battle that discouragement in your life as you leverage that to know Jesus, does not define the final destiny of where you will enter into glory. But you will walk faithfully and look to Christ in the midst of your discouragement. Maybe you find yourself very discouraged today. May I urge you to rest in the gospel, rest and look to the example of Israel as a warning to flee from cynicism and look to the cross of Christ. And so what happened to the Israelites? They had discouraging circumstances, but the discouragement turned sour. The discouragement turned sour. How do we know this? Look at what Moses wrote about the situation and what they said. Verse 5, "And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, but we loathe this worthless food." We know that this discouragement had turned sour in their hearts by what they thought about others and what they said. Their comments revealed an evil presumption about God and Moses' character and motives. "Why have you brought us up out of the land of Egypt to die in the wilderness?" Their comments revealed that they were led by their motives and not truth. It wasn't true that God led them to die. Actually, God brought him out of Egypt to live, to have life, to enjoy the promised land. It's easy in the midst of discouragement to believe things that aren't true. Their comments were filled with complaining and harsh criticism as they expressed ungrateful dissatisfaction to Moses and God for the food that they've been given. The psalmists many times describe manna as bread from heaven. And imagine describing the bread of heaven as worthless. What is vital for us to remember, their comments demonstrated a hopelessness. "Why have you brought us out to Egypt to die?" They saw their only option left was to die. The Israelites' discouragement had turned unnecessarily sour. It's easy to think that complaining doesn't hurt anyone. We think that we complain to our spouse, we complain to our kids, we complain to our coworkers, we complain actually just in our minds about the events of life, and we don't think it's a big deal, it's not hurting anyone. But complaining always is the statement of what you believe about a circumstance and what you believe about God. Let me give you an illustration. Imagine with me that you are around your family dinner table And it's been a very, very busy day. Dad, you've been super busy at work. Mom, you've had to work and you've run errands, and you both got home quickly, as fast as you could, to make supper. And maybe this is your life every single weekday. And the meal, it's spread on the table, and there's some chicken, there's some rice, and there's some veggies. And you call your son down for dinner, and he comes down, he sits at the table, and he says this: "I can't believe I came home for this meal. This is terrible. I should have just stayed in town and ate supper at McDonald's. This is worthless." Well, what would happen in your house? I know if I did that as a child, teenager coming home, did that to my parents, my dad would calmly lay down his fork. He would be very measured in his response to me, and he would ask me a very direct question: "Son, do you want to die?" My mother would chime in, says, "No, I'm going to kill him. I brought you into this world. I'm going to take you out, son. You're dead." Why would their reactions be so strong to a comment of his observation, how he thought about the circumstance? Well, it was because it wasn't just about the food. No, it's because his mom and dad worked hard to earn the money so they could buy the food, to bring home the food, to prepare the food. And the remarks weren't just about the food. The comments were about the provider of the food. "You didn't make what I really wanted. You could have done better. I could have done better for myself." Israel's comments about the food and the journey are wrong and sinful because they are comments and complaints about who is providing the food and who is leading the people. And what is vital to remember, even in our complaints, and we're going to see with the Israelites, that the wages of sin is death. Just as it was death for the older generation, it will be death for this generation. And so the Lord hears their comments, and he immediately sends a punishment. So the Lord, the third observation from this text, is that the Lord judges sin. How does the Lord judge the sin? Well, the Lord sends fiery serpents into the camp among the people. These fiery serpents refer to the look and the brilliance of the serpent. I'm sure they were probably red in some ways, but also they're fiery due to the way the snake bit into the person. And there was immense pain that would have been brought to the individual. It was a fiery pain, and it was death that was imminent. There's always a price to pay for sin. But the righteous judge is merciful to his people. It's interesting that the people knew the serpent was a consequence of sin.
Thank you, Pastor Ben. We'll conclude this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker, Ben Lamphere, is the executive pastor and the pastor for Soul Care at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. Join us every Sunday at 9:30 a.m. for our morning worship service. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about today's message or about Palmetto Baptist Church, you can email radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Grow in Grace is recorded by the audio team at Palmetto Baptist Church, and it's edited by C.J. DeLeo. Thanks for listening. Join us next time so together we can grow in grace.